come up on the tight wire.
I'm sitting here in Studio B, sitting across from my good friend Daniel Chacon.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend Benjamin Alida Sainz.
And welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
Today we have a very exciting and personally exciting show with Veronica Reyes. And she just came out with this book called Chopper Chopper, which is an imprint of Red Hand Press, which is an awesome poetry press. But she was your student, and you were the chair of her thesis committee.
Absolutely. That was many, 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 many years ago, and she was actually a really great student.
And you know what's really fantastic is she graduated in 2000. She's been working, writing poetry, not giving up, writing poetry and poetry, and she finally got a book out after over 10 years. And you know what? It's worth the wait. It's a fantastic book.
And good for her.
Speaking of former students, this is a really special poetic license for me because when I first started here as a professor, I had the student in my class. He was incredibly sweet and incredibly talented, one of the most talented writers in my class. His name was Will Rose. And I've known him for 14 years. We've become friends, very close friends in the last couple of years. And he's going to do today's poetic license.
So this could be kind of be like a centennial show. UTEP Centennial Show. Yeah. UTEP students come back.
Celebrating 100 years because between you and me teaching here, it probably adds up to about 100 years.
Our ages add up to more than that.
We were talking the other day, speaking of ages, about how words shift. You know, like when I was a kid, if you called somebody a dork, you're going to fight. You don't call anybody a dork. It was an insult. But today, I freely call my good friend Benjamin Alida Sainz a dork, and he really is a dork. But as the culture has shifted, the term dork now means a compliment. You say, right. Hey, you're such a dork. It's an affectionate term.
But I am a dork.
You are. And I say that affectionately.
A dork is someone who's like old school, a little klutzy.
But very charming.
Okay.
A dork is charming.
I'll take that. Just like a geek.
A geek. A geek is a good thing now.
A geek is a good thing too. He's a computer geek.
Yeah. And we say,
he's
one
a
example,
poetry geek. It used to be bad to be a geek, and now it's good to be a geek. Every dog has its day.
But you know what? I'm a little depressed, Ben.
Why is that?
Because, unfortunately, I'm cool. I'm just way too cool. I'm not a geek. Cool guys like me just have no future.
Dork.
Okay, you know another word that I think is, the other day we were talking about words? Snarky.
I just said that people use the word snarky, and you said nobody uses the word snarky.
Nobody
anymore.
Does.
But I use the word snarky all the time.
Can I just kind of say this? You just got another honor for Everything Begins and Ends in the Kentucky Club. And I don't mean to sound snarky, Ben, but dang, homeboy.
There's a Rainbow Award, which is a Rainbow LGBT Award, under the auspices of the American Library Association.
Oh, it's an actual award.
And it's an award.
Wow.
Because there's awards in different categories. So I won for my category, which is the literature category, the adult literature category. Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club was given the Rainbow Award in that category.
Wow.
And then it was also a Stonewall Honor Book, again, under the auspices of the American Library Association.
Another Stonewall. Didn't you get one last year?
Yeah, for Aristotle and Dante.
My gosh, Ben, you are sweeping up the awards. You know, I'm going to be snarky because, you know, you've got to leave some awards for the rest of the writers. We have on the show today Veronica Reyes. I just saw her in Los Angeles. I did a reading with her, actually. We both were the featured readers in Echo Park.
She's really fierce and really tough and really tender and kind.
Yeah. Stick around and we'll be right back.
Words on a Wire. This week on Words on a Wire, our guest is Veronica Reyes, who is a Chicana feminist poet from East L.A. She earned her B.A. from California State University, Long Beach, and her M.F.A. from the University of Texas at El Paso. Her poems give voice to all her communities, Chicanas, Chicanos, immigrants, Mexican Americans, and La Joteria. Reyes has won AWP's Intro Journal Project and Austria Lesbian Foundation Emerging Artist Award, and was a finalist for the Andrés Montoya Poetry Award. She is a proud member of Mujeres Activas en Letras y Cambio Social. Veronica, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you.
And congratulations on your book of poems, Chopper Chopper, Poetry from Bordered Lives.
It is a pleasure, and thank you for the beautiful introduction.
Hey, Silvero, How long did it take you to write this book? I know that you've been working on poetry manuscripts, and it's probably different ones, for a long, long time. You were a student here in our MFA program. When? A long time ago.
2000.
Yeah, a long time ago. We're looking at, I started in 97, I finished in 2000, but I stood 3 year extra to teach in the local community college there.
Yeah, when I was a new professor, when I was being interviewed on my campus visit, Veronica was graduating that year, and I met her.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, you and your friend took me up to the very first time Scenic Drive, and if you're not from El Paso, Scenic Drive is this amazing view of the Twin Cities, Ciudad Juarez and El Paso, and you guys showed that to me for the first time, and I was stunned.
You know, I have that image all the time, actually. When I start thinking I need something to calm down, the sunset up there is just beautiful.
Absolutely.
It's one of those that kind of just sticks in your mind, and when I think of sunsets, I think of that.
You know, your work is so tied into a sense of creating community. For you, is it fair to say that your poetry is your way of doing community activism?
I think so. It's always been my need. When I first started reading Chicano literature for me in the 90s, I just kept on saying, well, where's the rest of us? I mean, yes, I mean, I like the story and it's good, beautiful writing, but that's not my experience. I want more. I want something that reflects what it means to live in this barrio and how it means to survive here and just to enjoy life. So I think in that sense, yeah, definitely my writing is that form of, it's really politicized. And it comes back to, we have to, for me, acknowledge the existence of the diverse voices and existences that are here within this East LA or just different parts of the U.S., really. Because I've traveled quite a bit now to kind of see things and open up my mind in a different framework.
And do you think it's more, the journey has been more difficult for you because you were a Chicana lesbian in terms of publications?
Yeah, I mean, this book right here, Ben, there's probably about 10, 12 poems that come from my thesis. And throughout the years, I've written new pieces. So the book has changed so much from, 112 pages to 80 pages. Then I had to squeeze it down to 52 pages. And it was submitted so many places. It was consistent rejection. And it really was because of ArcToy. If ArcToy Books, which is a lesbian press by Eloise Klein-Healy, if that press wouldn't have accepted it, then I probably still would have been really going at it still. The beauty was for me was at one point I got some really good advice about like this idea of course, don't give up. And I just kind of really pushed it. But definitely Chicano presses were not going to accept this because some of the language that's in there, I guess, Panocha power is too much.
Right.
Or Marimacha. And I don't really have anything really vivid. There's nothing really that intense descriptive where I'm giving some, there's no real intense eroticism or anything like that. But I think it's interesting. I think it's the politics that pushes people away or the fact that there's a lot of narrative writing in it. And so sometimes I think they don't think I know what I'm doing. And I know what I'm doing.
Right.
I've been practicing this craft for a while. It's done purposely.
So you think that they kind of used an aesthetic argument when they rejected your book instead of getting to the real reason why they were rejecting the book?
I think to some extent that's one part of it. The other part is just didn't fit their taste. They didn't want this book. It wasn't going to... And that's probably one of the things I'm struggling a little bit right now is how to promote this book. I'm really, as the poet, having to do quite a bit of things. Even though I have a really good small press, I feel like I'm still the first one for them. I may be the first Chicana dyke that they really have to work with. And I've had to fight for certain things. Just for little things is, there's a reason why there's spacing in a Chicana theorist. It matters that the line is under here and this word starts here. Because space matters. And that's implied within the poem. And the same thing with Panocha Power and a few other poems. And I could tell they thought they were just doing it, well, it looks pretty this way. So my spacing was moved. So I've had to really argue for that and really get them to say, no, okay, put it back to the original, what it was originally. Although some things didn't change, actually Panocha Power never really changed from what it was from when I first wrote it, whereas other pieces did change dramatically.
Right.
The LA Rivers one. But then there's newer pieces like, of course, Desert Rain that we worked at it just to clean up little things.
The whole process is so integrated with you. your identity and your writing, and all of that is seems to be all of one piece and very integrated. And I find that really admirable in your work, because you really are speaking about things you really need to talk about, and no one has to ask, well, why is this important? Maybe someone won't like it, but they know that it comes from a voice that really needs to speak. And I really, really admire that about your work. But it must be very difficult, and it must take its toll on you.
I think the toll is the fact that it was a long road to get here. I think that things are changing from the last few years, of course. Things have changed, and it's getting, of course, things are better than it was 20 years ago or, 15 years ago. But I think for students, when I see them, and this happened in Basel too, and this is what always gives me that little push, is when you see that young baby Dyke come out, and they're so happy to see me up front. And I haven't really done anything other than I'm standing in front of the classroom, and they're just thrilled that I'm present. It's those moments that you say, okay, I'm doing the right thing. And, of course, when you're teaching, it just has that moment where they learn. And so part of that, too, of writing and having to do a lot of poetry readings in the last few months, it's getting people who I didn't think even would actually really like it really say, wow, that was really a good reading, or I really like that poem, or I could see where you're going at. And it's like, wow, this guy looks like a maton, but that's cool. I just had a read with this guy. I think he was a former inmate. And I thought, that's not the person I expected to actually really enjoy that piece. But he did, and that's cool. And that was actually kind of nice because it's breaking that barrier.
Right.
As well. And poetry becomes accessible, and I want that. Poetry to be accessible to the people, for people to get it. And it's not supposed to be just be in academia. It is about crossing boundaries within literature, touching communities, whether it's neighborhoods where I grew up at or otherwise.
Is teaching for you, do you feel estranged from the community when you teach, or do you feel drawn closer to the community?
Well, you know what? I think the thing, of course, that draws me close is the fact that I take the bus. I'm on the bus. And when I'm on the bus, nobody ever even conceives me as being a poet or an educator. I'm just one of the individuals taking the bus in the morning or the evening and just part of the community.
Does that help your writing, taking the bus?
Yes, it does, because it allows me to have these dialogues and to see people. And when you become like a regular bus driver and certain passengers and certain commutes, you get to see how people interact with each other and the kindness that people have, as well as, of course, the things that are not very nice that happen.
Right.
But you see the reality of it. So I don't feel really that estranged, because I also teach at Cal State LA, and Cal State LA for me is very much like UTEP. It is a community that's, or institution that's predominantly Latino, and most of the students are coming from the local environment. You don't really have a lot of students coming from other states or cities. It really is community-based in that sense. So they're coming from El Sereno, City Terrace, or Boyle Heights. They are from my community, and so they're all first-generation students as well. And so I think that for me is to get them to recognize their own strengths. And so I always promote, you have to go back to your communities, because you're probably one of the first in your families to enter academia. We have a responsibility. And that's something that I always believe. We have a responsibility to do something more. And I think my job is within academia, but at the same time, as a poet, I like to share these stories. This is what I know, and this is what I've seen. And hopefully I've done it with some, where somebody could see themselves and say, yeah, I like what you wrote, or yeah, I get it.
We're talking to Veronica Reyes, whose new book, Chopper Chopper, Poetry from the Bordered Lives, just came out with Arctoy Press, an imprint of Red Hand Press, which is an amazing publisher of poetry. Did you just submit cold? How did you get this book published? I mean, after, 10 years of writing and working and struggling, how did it finally come about?
Well, there are many of those things that happen. I was an NEA fellow at VCCA, so Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, and somebody mentioned to me, well, how many places have you submitted to? And I kind of mentioned, well, not a very big number. And she said, no, that's not enough. And then, and I started having to think about it. It was like, well, okay, what do I really need to put together? I happened then to go to, I remember it was a Napa Valley Writers Conference, and somebody had mentioned at a craft talk, it took them 70 entries to contests and to just to presses, and I started to put all these things together, and I was like, well, I got to do this. I really need a book out. So I wrote my final poem, East L.A. Poet. I decided actually, probably known, to sit down and really just put that last poem that was going to put everything together, and I think that's what East L.A. Poet does. It just says, this is who I am, and this is why I write. I part of Macondo Writers Foundation, Writers Workshop, and I met somebody there, and she said something, you should submit to ArcToy Books. And I said, well, what's that? And she mentioned it, and it was Chingy Chen who mentioned that to me. And finally, I just kind of put everything together, and I realized, I actually was thinking of Rick DeMarinas, who was teaching at UTEP, and I remember him saying a good poetry book is about 48, 52 pages. So that was my goal. So I put 52 pages. So I took that long book that was 80 and took out things that I thought that, no, this is not really what I want. I want something that really reflects me. So I sent out this book that was 52 pages, and I was just calling it at the time East L.A. Poet, Poetry from Border Lives, because I didn't know. I knew the title wasn't great, but I knew the poems would at least capture somebody. And I sent it to Eloise, and I got a little email from her, and it was just something really simple and sweet. She said, gotcha, you know, your manuscript arrived. Great to hear from a local gal. And I thought, oh, I wonder. And a couple months later, I thought the same thing. I was like, it just kept on crossing my path that maybe this one. And then in January, I got the phone call from her and acknowledging the receipt of the acceptance of it.
How did you feel?
Well, you know what? After a decade of doing this and really kind of working it, having to do overloading of teaching and not teach at times, I literally, I cried a little. I cried.
Oh, nice.
It was a hard road. And I don't think that many people realize how hard it is when you're a woman of color, when you're, you know, lesbian of color, to do this, to actually put that time and effort, because most people just don't, they think you just submit it. And if you're not coming from, I think the other reality is if you're not coming from an institution, during my time frame, an institution that people go, wow, you know, at the time nobody was saying, wow, El Paso, you went to El Paso, UTEP.
Right.
You don't get picked up, you don't get looked at the same. Oh, you have MFA. They're like, oh, they want the Iowa Writers Workshop. They still want the Columbia, you know, the Cornell or the NYU.
And right, the lesser schools.
Yeah. And in the end, I realized, no, this is my path. I think I meant to do this for not just me, but because El Paso matters just as much as East L.A. and all the other barrio communities.
Tell us a little bit about the title, and then if you don't mind, can you pick a poem and read it to us?
Okay, the title, Chopper Chopper, is actually from the title of one of my poems, Chopper Chopper, and I thought that it represented, kind of captured the rest of it, the entire book. At the same time, actually my partner, because I struggled with the title for a while, I had something else before poetry, before Border Life. And she mentioned too, we're really working at it. And I looked at her and said, yeah, that's it, Chopper Chopper. Why was I looking everyone else so I could just look at home? Why just come back to home? So I knew that Chopper Chopper was in the main title, Poetry for the Border Lives. That was that one link that I wanted to keep because it still connected me to, it was like having that favorite or your little ritual of holding on to something in the sense of it linked me to my El Paso days, it linked me to Toronto and back to East L.A., and it really kind of captured the idea of, we're talking about people who are forced to be bordered, and yet at the same time we're talking about the frontera, and at the same time we're talking about the visual imagery of what border means.
And
so I liked that there was many layers to it. It was not as simplistic as it may imply at times.
It references the so-called ghetto birds of the urban landscape. Right, the helicopters, the police helicopters flying over and shining their lights on everybody?
Yeah, well, from Chopper Chopper, yeah. And it was a game that we played as kids, too. We would actually play a game because I grew up near two jails. Yeah, so we played a game called Chopper Chopper, in which, or we also had the other one, we played La Migra, and everyone ran.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. Thanks so much for being on our show. And would you read Chopper Chopper for us?
Chopper Chopper is very long.
Okay.
So I think I'll read just the first poem, Desiree.
Okay.
Veronica Reyes is going to read from her book, Chopper Chopper, a poem called Desert Rain, Blessing the Land.
Thick clouds pulled over the cielo like a charcoal rebozo. Blood clots pounded as if manos la masa together, thundering their message, I'm coming, I'm coming. And the withering grass, like a viejito perked up to see a barrio. Everyone looked up to the gray-white puffs draping the sky, nopal and hefty maguey stretched upward for fat drops. They waited so long for summer rains to inspire life again. And the sky opened its boca in autumn, a desert rain wind. Streams of plancotas fell on top of the thirsty tierra, splattering the ground, leaving half lunas on the land. Socorro stepped outside her blue home near the freeway, let the warm water wet a brown orange by the awning's edge. She inhaled deeply, muy sacate, tierra, driveway, Zacatecas, el valle de mi corazón, Sochi. Allá en el pueblito donde yo nací, olía como ocotillo y tunas. Sochi clung to her mom's pale blue vestido, smiled, and stared at the big sky was standing on the red porch. Bowed a little sueño to herself and kept it tucked inside. She proclaimed proudly in her six-year-old voice, Zacatecas, mami, Zacatecas. Socorro laughed, and with her moist fingers, she anointed herself and her daughter with midday desert rain in the city. The agua took her back to her childhood in Mexico, rain that blessed her alma como copal, shrouding her skin. She inhaled the desert aroma over concrete, nopales, and limones beneath splintered street telephone wires. Socorro breathed in once and inhaled Mexico in East L.A.
That was wonderful.
Thank you, Veronica.
Thank you.
And thanks for being on Words on a Wire. And I wish you much success with your book. You've worked so hard. Congratulations again. Chopper, Chopper, Poetry from Boarded Lives by Veronica Reyes. It's been a pleasure having you, Veronica.
I'm honored to, in some sense, to have had you as my professor. I appreciate it.
The honor was all mine, Vero.
My name is William Alfred Rose. I am a writer, former musician, and a marketing professional based out of Phoenix, Arizona. For my poetic license today, I am going to reflect on my childhood spent in front of the piano. This is entitled Electricity. Mrs. Packard, my first piano teacher, was as old as a redwood. She lived on 4th Street, off Avenue D, near the center of town, in a yellow house that had a long driveway. I remember when my mother would drop me off on Saturday mornings, I would look back at her several times before arriving at the front door, always nervous to enter the old woman's home. Mrs. Packard's fingers had long since been ruined by arthritis, frozen in a way that made me think of crawfish. But she could still teach. When I made a mistake or got lost in a piece, she would reach over me and cup her palms over my knuckles and guide me through the rest of the stanza. Even now, 30 years later, the foggy scent of antique furniture makes me think of her. I was only 5 when I started my weekly lessons. During those early years, I was eager to please my mother, who did not see the piano as a musical instrument, but as a symbol of her American dream, a mark of affluence, and a point of reference that was very distant from the post-war Korea she grew up in. "You are lucky," she would always say. My mother would tell me about the times she ate ants for protein, or the afternoons she and her sister spent picking wild dandelion greens to sell at the market or to feed themselves. Her childhood stories were relentlessly consistent in theme, always used as a tool to guilt me into an appreciation of my improbable childhood. Over the next 13 years, until my 18th birthday, I never missed a single lesson. I mastered Czerny's practice methods, Hannon's finger exercises, and Chopin's etudes. I quickly learned Mozart sonatas and got through Debussy with relative ease. It might have been inevitable, then, that I'd eventually rebel. That, as a young, spoiled person, I'd learned to hate the piano, to loathe the hours I would spend practicing on the Yamaha Grand my parents spent so much of their hard-earned money on. By my teenage years, any desire for it was gone. As I reflect on it now, it is difficult to accept that I was much more interested in watching sports commentary on TV or playing video games. No, it was actually worse than that. Playing the piano had become, at the height of my abilities, an embarrassment, as silly and as ungrateful as that might sound. It embarrassed me that I could read music. It embarrassed me that I performed at recitals. It embarrassed me so much, in fact, that I kept it mostly a secret. Only my closest friends knew about this other life of mine, my alternate existence as a classically trained pianist, But even then, I would deflect it as much as I could. I'd call it keyboard lessons, or that I was a keyboardist, which somehow felt less embarrassing. The piano, I had thought, was something only little Korean girls played. A woman named Eunmi would be my final piano teacher. Unlike Mrs. Packard so many years earlier, Eunmi was young, pretty, and like my mother, born and raised in South Korea, sharing a similar worldview. She had the misfortune of seeing me through my high school years, but despite my souring attitude, she had a particular affection for me. Like my mother, she did not care that I hated the piano, or hated the practice, or wished more than anything else that I could quit. To them, this was no different than not liking school. So what? You still needed to go, and you still needed to do well. I was lucky, Eunmi would remind me. I also happened to be Eunmi's only male student over the age of 10, which meant I was a rare opportunity for her to teach works that required larger hands. And so those final years were immersed in Beethoven's more difficult pieces, with even a failed attempt at Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 3 in D minor. When I think about all this now, I am both amazed and disappointed. I think, what a waste. I wish I could tell that young foolish boy to understand and appreciate the magic he was able to create with his fingers. After moving out, going to college, negotiating the adult world, I would lose memory of my childhood spent in front of the piano. But then I would see someone playing, or hear a Nora Jones song on the radio, and it would resurface once again. But the really amazing thing is, after all these years, I can still play. Muscle memory, I suppose. In rare moments over the years, I would see a lonely piano and surprise my friends or a date as if it were a bar trick. As improbable as it might seem, after so many years of neglect, I can still sit down at the keyboard and watch my hands take their position. And when I close my eyes, I can see the bands of color swimming through darkness, an electricity that begins somewhere in my brain and ends inside the muscle of my hands and fingers. For Words on a Wire, I'm William Alfred Rose.
We'd like to thank Veronica Reyes for joining us today. It was a great interview.
And a great poem she read.
Oh, absolutely. I love that one. And we'd also like to thank my former student. Veronica was your former student. Will was my former student for his poetic license on the piano.
So we've come to an end of another show. We'd like to thank our producer, Norma Martinez. And again, stay tuned next week for another edition of Words on a Wire. And remember,
the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place me, a comedy of errors and I'm falling like a rubber giraffe. You look into my past. Well, maybe you're just too blind to see. I'm up in the spotlight.